This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 20, 2002. I'm Nell Abram. Truce talks continue in the Middle East despite more violence in the region. The U.S. Senate is poised to pass the campaign finance reform legislation. Critics prepare to challenge the bill's constitutionality. And we'll begin a three-day look inside Camp X-Ray at Guantanamo Bay. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. France has warned the United States they could stop cooperating with the September 11th investigation if the United States seeks the death penalty against the French national charged with aiding the people behind the attacks. Sputnik Colombi reports from Paris.
Human rights groups, including Amnesty International, say Justice Minister Marlise Lebranchu told them in a letter that she'd instructed her officials to contact the U.S. Justice Department to voice concern that information obtained in France could put Zacharias Moussaoui on death row. The 33-year-old is charging with conspiring with Saudi-born militant Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda network in connection with the September 11th attacks. After reaching an agreement with the French government, U.S. prosecutor Robert Spencer attempted to interview Moussaoui's relatives in France this week. But rights groups say such information cannot be used by prosecutors pressing for a death penalty. Sputnik Kilambi in Paris for Free Speech Radio News.
Trade unionists, students, environmentalists, and human rights groups demonstrated outside the Danish parliament today to protest the nation's budget. Patrick Beckett explains from Copenhagen.
More than 10,000 people gathered for a demonstration outside of the Danish parliament today. The majority of demonstrators were trade unionists concerned with social reforms and new legislation limiting union organizing. In other parts of the city, thousands of students demonstrated against education reforms and budget cuts in environmental and social areas of the economy. There were industrial actions in other parts of Denmark as well, including the Copenhagen International Airport. More than 100 flights were canceled throughout the day. The new budget is a production of the center-right and conservative parties, who now have a majority in the recently elected government. In Copenhagen, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Patrick Beckett.
Today, a Harare court ordered Zimbabwe's opposition leader to pay bail in an amount equivalent to $30,000 as he faces charges of high treason for his alleged involvement in an assassination plot against President Mugabe. Zoe Eisenstein reports from Harare.
Tsvangirai's lawyer described the bail hearing as a knee-jerk reaction to Zimbabwe's suspension from the Commonwealth announced on Tuesday. The charge against Tsvangirai relates to blurry video footage allegedly showing he and two other high-ranking MDC officials discussing President Mugabe's assassination, a charge all three deny. The magistrate judge ordered Tsvangirai to pay more than his co-accused, but less than the prosecution had called for. Tsvangirai is remanded until April the 30th. If convicted, he could face the death penalty. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zoe Eisenstein in Harare, Zimbabwe.
This week, the World Food Program announced an emergency relief effort will begin immediately in Guatemala to cope with hunger resulting from long-term drought. Alicia Steele has more from Guatemala.
Last year, a severe drought caused by El Nino resulted in at least 31,000 families losing most of their basic crop of beans and corn, and who are now quickly running out of food. 47% of children under 5 years old suffer high levels of malnutrition, and it is estimated that 6,000 infants are at risk of dying if immediate action is not taken. The Guatemalan Minister of Public Health, Mario Bolanos, states that malnutrition is not solved by simply handing out food. What is needed are macroeconomic changes in the economy and politics in order to create the fair distribution of wealth so that everyone has access to food. This is Alicia Steele reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Quetzaltenango, Guatemala.
And finally, the Supreme Court will decide if age discrimination laws protect older workers from more broadly instituted corporate policies that seem to target them for dismissal. Gareth Schweitzer reports from the Supreme Court.
When Wanda Adams realized that 70% of the workers laid off by the Florida Power Corporation between 1992 and 1996 were over the age of 40, she and 117 other former employees filed an age discrimination suit. The Florida Power Corporation asserts that the company had legitimate, non-discriminatory reasons for firing the workers. John G. Crabtree, leading attorney for the Adams Group, argued that this case is vital to ensuring that the Age Discrimination and Employment Act can effectively protect against discrimination in the workplace.
Generally, people simply have these sort of these notions in their heads that older workers can't do things that are often inaccurate. And what the Act seeks to do is to preclude those stereotypes from functioning in the workplace and keeping older workers from being able to contribute to society.
At the Supreme Court in Washington, I'm Gareth Schweitzer for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Palestinian security officials say today that a ceasefire declaration is possible after a joint security meeting later this afternoon. The Palestinian Authority said yesterday it is fully ready to begin implementing the tenant plan. The areas from which the Israeli Defense Force withdrew remained quiet, but there were incidents in other areas of the West Bank and Gaza. Awad Duwaris has more from Ramallah.
Palestinian Authority condemned the suicide attack that took place this morning on the road between Tel Aviv and Nazareth in the region of Wadi Ara. The same attack was claimed by the radical Islamic Palestinian movement, the Islamic Jihad, and killed 7 Israelis, including 4 Israeli soldiers, and injured another 30 persons. Some 10 of them were announced in critical conditions. Before a regular Israeli security cabinet meeting after such an attack, unlikely to similar situations, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon declared that the Israeli response will not be a massive military strike. Sharon argumented considering the attack as a provocation of Arafat, who does not do enough efforts to prevent terrorism, as he said. Palestinians rejected these accusations, saying that it is a reaction to the previous Israeli military escalation in Palestinian territories. Nevertheless, a Palestinian spokesman considered that the suicide attack is a sabotage of General Zini's mission in the region, which aims to reach a truce and a sustainable ceasefire. At the diplomatic level, American envoy Anthony Zini met again with Arafat in Ramallah, and he is due to lead a joint Palestinian-Israeli security meeting in Jerusalem tonight. A difficult mission of Zini and a world that seemed to be impossible between actions and reactions and the exchange of accusations between Israelis and Palestinians. For a Free Speech Radio News, this is Awad Davis reporting from Ramallah.
Free Speech Radio News correspondent and death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal has these thoughts on the United States' role in the Middle East.
As Israeli tanks rumble through Palestinian lands and tens of thousands of Israeli troops trash hundreds of Palestinian homes, the President of the United States speaks at a rare live press conference of the U.S. ally's military assault. "I think it's unhelpful," he says. In one of the Palestinian people's darkest hours, when Ramallah and its refugee camps are being ravaged by over 20,000 Israeli troops, hundreds of tanks, and the relentless repression of F-16 air power, the response of the American government is insipid, uninspired, and reflective of the overwhelming bias that marks the U.S. stance in regards to the Middle East conflict. While U.S. diplomats and politicians repeatedly call for peace, the U.S. can hardly be called a fair arbiter. Consider, for example, the role of the U.S. in the halls of the United Nations whenever Palestinian issues were put forward. For example, Resolution 33110 on living conditions of the Palestinian people, date December 18, 1978. The vote was 110-2, U.S. and Israel voting against. Or Resolution 34113, a request for a report on the living conditions of the Palestinians in occupied Arab nations. That was December 14th, 1979. Vote 120-2. Guess who voted against? Or Resolution 34133, the Assistance to Palestinian People Resolution of December 14th, 1979. The vote 112-3, U.S., Israel, and Canada. Resolution 35169C, the Rights of Palestinians of 12-15-1980. The vote, 120-3, the U.S., Israel, and Australia voting against. The writer could have extended the list, but the point is made. Is there any wonder that either Palestinians in particular or Arabs in general feel that the U.S. is ill-suited to arbitrate between the two sides? Whenever a Palestinian harms an Israeli, the U.S. is quick to castigate Arafat for not doing enough for peace. When Israeli soldiers or settlers engage in anti-Arab violence, there is either deafening silence from the U.S. or the same type of tepid, lukewarm, unhelpful comments that President Bush made in response to the recent massive military incursions in Ramallah and refugee camps. The UN Security Council recently voted, with U.S. support, for a resolution approving the establishment of a Palestinian state. Has the U.S. suddenly, like Saul on the road to Damascus, seen the light? Hardly. In this new age of global war, even the U.S. empire had to act in a certain way to placate Arab allies like Egypt and Saudi Arabia. The question is, what kind of state? An independent sovereign territory or a proxy for U.S. and Israeli interests? A nation is far more than a flag, a capital, and an airport, especially in this age of imperial globalist hunger and unbridled power. Unless events drastically change, a Palestinian state will be what Israel and the U.S. allows, and no more. From Death Row, for Free Speech Radio, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Military tribunals the Bush administration plans to use for trying terrorism suspects will resemble ordinary military court-martial in many respects, but defendants will have only limited rights to appeal. Details of the tribunal regulations began to emerge today. According to advance word from Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, he does expect a lot of controversy because the planned military tribunals will be unlike anything the public has ever seen. These trials will be held outside the United States. Guantanamo Bay is one likely location. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Shannon Novak arrived there this afternoon and is talking with us from the military airport terminal in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Shannon, any word from Guantanamo Bay on when the tribunals will begin?
This morning, Brigadier General Michael Lernhardt, who is the commander of the joint task force that goes on here at Guantanamo Bay, did speak with the press. One member of the press asked him about this. He looked quite shocked, frankly, and said that it was news to him and refused to comment any further.
Shannon, have you visited Camp X-Ray?
This afternoon we were taken to Camp X-Ray. They put us in an area where you can't really see the faces of the detainees, and the reason for that is in the Geneva Convention that you cannot take photographs of faces and make people identifiable. So we were at quite a distance. We did, as soon as we arrived, begin to hear a lot of voices. Like a lot of talking, and a little chaotic, and we asked the public affairs people that were escorting us what was going on. They said that they didn't feel that was any different. There is a member of the press who's here all the time, and she reported that she had never heard that before. Then there was the call for prayer. It comes over a loudspeaker on a tape if the Muslim chapel is unavailable, and it did today on a tape. You then see the detainees with their towels that they use as prayer mats, and they go into prayer. After that was over, they did take us in a van a bit closer to the detainees. Through closed windows, we were able to observe them a little more. And what you saw were rows and rows of these 8x8 chain-linked fenced cells. And it seemed to me, being a Midwest girl, it seemed to me almost like chicken coops. And that same, much larger, of course, but that same sort of display, one after another, upon row. And inside of them, of course, the orange jumpsuit with one of the detainees.
Shannon, tell us a bit about what it was like gaining access to Guantanamo Bay and what you had to go through to get there.
It is not an easy process. The United States military allows 20 members of the press at one time, and that's not just press from the United States, it's worldwide press. And they'll bring a transport out twice a week. So out of the entire world, there's only 40 press people that come through in a week. And, of course, everybody wants access. So it took a long time. Once you get the okay that you can go on a transport, your history needs to be cleared through the Department of State and through the Pentagon. Then once that happens, you get on a flight from wherever you are to Puerto Rico. And once in Puerto Rico, then you must get yourself to Roosevelt Roads Naval Base, which is about an hour from the airport. And the arrival time at Roosevelt Roads is 5 a.m., so it becomes an expensive trip for many of the press members, as you must also see overnight in San Juan. At 5 a.m., we arrived at Roosevelt Roads, put all of our belongings out in front of us, stepped back, and dogs came out to smell our belongings. Once we gathered our things together, we were taken into the air terminal there, where we were briefed. About 3 hours later, we departed by plane, and it wasn't what I had expected. After traveling on many military transports, it was quite the luxury liner. I wish the ticket that I had purchased to get down to San Juan, the plane would have been quite as nice as the one the military took us over in. About 90 minutes later, we arrived in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and then were taken for a brief tour, taken for a press conference with Brigadier General Michael Learnhardt, and then taken out to Camp X-Ray. In the general's opening remarks this morning, he thanked the members of the press for coming out and said, and I quote, "Thank you for coming to record the experience of a genuine historic event. After what I've seen this afternoon, after the things that Secretary Rumsfeld has said regarding the military tribunals, I believe the genuine historic event may even be an understatement." For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shannon Novak, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
The congressional battle over campaign finance reform may end today. The Senate voted to close debate on the bill banning unregulated or soft money contributions and raising the limit on individual hard money contributions from wealthy individuals. As Free Speech Radio News goes to air, the Senate is poised to pass the bill. But if President Bush signs it, reform opponents say they'll challenge the package in the Supreme Court, arguing it puts limits on free speech. It's not clear if the bill can pass constitutional muster. Joshua Chaffin reports from Capitol Hill.
Under the bill, soft money is out. No more unlimited contributions from corporations and labor unions. But the individual contribution limit would go up from $1,000 to $2,000. In debate on the Senate floor today, Democratic Senator Paul Wellstone of Minnesota lamented having to make that compromise.
During the last election, 4 citizens out of 10,000 Americans made contributions greater than $200. I mean, only 232,000 Americans gave contributions of $1,000 or more. So this was 0.1% of the voting age population. So by bumping the spending limits up, I think that we just further maximize the leverage and the influence and, frankly, the power of the wealthiest citizens in the country. And I regret that. I opposed it. It is part of the bill.
Senator Mitch McConnell, a Kentucky Republican and principal opponent of the bill, says the 60-day blackout rule in the bill gives preferential treatment to media conglomerates at the expense of individuals.
This bill seeks to make people go register with the federal government and raise hard dollars to have anything to say about any of us within 60 days of an election, unless you own a newspaper. If you're a big corporation that owns a newspaper, you have no restraints. If you're a big corporation that doesn't own a newspaper, you have a bunch of restraints. So the effort here is to give some people more First Amendment rights than others.
Which is one of the things McConnell says makes the bill unconstitutional. Senator McConnell admits the congressional battle over reform is essentially over, but opponents say they'll take their case to the Supreme Court, where they'll likely focus on the bill's limits to so-called issue ads, advertisements which purport to advocate for one side of a particular issue, but which are used most often to push the position of a particular candidate. The Supreme Court will eventually have to decide whether money counts as speech.
The court has actually said in the past that money is speech because it fuels speech, and that's been a very controversial position the court has taken.
Larry Noble, executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics in D.C., was general counsel for the Federal Elections Commission for 13 years.
The question then becomes, does the government have a compelling enough reason to regulate that speech? And that's really the question here, is the potential for corruption or the appearance of corruption brought about by large campaign contributions a sufficient enough concern to limit the ability of corporations and labor unions to use funds to take on political speech?
Larry Noble says nobody doubts big donors are already finding loopholes to this reform package, and he wonders whether the Federal Elections Commission would even enforce it. But Democrat Tom Daschle said this morning at least Congress is trying to do something to change the system. As Senate Majority Leader, Daschle says under the current campaign finance rules, senators are too busy on the phone trying to raise money for their campaigns to come to work and vote on bills.
They're either repaying the debt that they've run up from the last election, or they're already putting money in the bank knowing how much they've got to raise for the next cycle. We've got to change that. Now, I would hasten to add, I'm not sure that this legislation in and of itself is going to change it. It could make it worse in some respects because you have to go to more people, make more phone calls. That's right.
Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Capitol Hill.
Today in Tampa, a former federal prosecutor and Nazi hunter filed a civil suit against controversial University of South Florida professor Sami Al-Arian, claiming he laundered money from the Saudi Arabian government to fund terrorism abroad. The suit is yet another chapter in the Al-Arian saga that began in the mid-1990s, but was renewed after Al-Arian appeared on the Fox News program The O'Reilly Factor last September. Mitch Perry has the story from Tampa.
Last month, the U.S. Attorney's Office released a statement affirming that Sami Al-Arian is under investigation by federal authorities. The brief press release led to speculation regarding whether this is new or simply continuing the FBI's search into allegations that Al-Arian's think tank and charitable organizations on the University of South Florida campus were fronts for the Middle East terrorist group, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. But former federal prosecutor John Loftus says his contacts in the intelligence and law enforcement agencies have informed him that the State Department and lower levels of the White House have squashed that investigation, and that's why he's coming forth with his own civil suit.
I received a lot of calls from, I have confidential clients within the intelligence community saying that the federal government prosecutors had been ordered not to prosecute Sami Al-Arian back in 1995. Because they didn't want to embarrass the Saudi government. This is an old problem, one I've been working on for a long time.
Loftus gained fame in the early 80s as a Nazi hunter. He counts among his career highlights an expose of Nazis working for the CIA that ultimately helped CBS's 60 Minutes win awards for outstanding investigative journalism. The novelty in Loftus's lawsuit is inserting the Saudi government into the by now familiar charges against the chemical engineering professor, who has been on paid suspension since death threats were received by him and the University of South Florida after his appearing on the O'Reilly Factor. Loftus's complaint says that the single largest source of funding for Al-Arian's charities were from a tax-exempt charity in Herndon, Virginia. He says confidential sources discovered that that address was used by foundations and charities donated through agents of the Saudi government, and that information led the State Department to tell Justice to terminate their investigation of Al-Arian.
The money comes from the Saudi government through a network of four Saudi charities in Herndon, Virginia. The money then gets distributed to Sami. Sami distributes overseas. And it wasn't just for Sami's Palestinian Islamic group. The Saudi front in Herndon, Virginia also bought the communications gear for Osama bin Laden, and it was a member of Sami's network who hand-carried the equipment to Afghanistan to deliver to Osama bin Laden.
When contacted shortly afterwards, Sami Al-Arian said Loftus's charges are insane.
It's absolutely preposterous. Whoever wrote this is a lunatic that belongs to an asylum.
Last week, University of South Florida President Judy Genshaft met with members of the American Association of University Professors as she weighs on whether or not to go ahead and fire Al-Arian. The AAUP says they could censure the school for violating academic freedom if Al-Arian is terminated simply because of comments he made on a cable television program. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
The Denver City Council passed a resolution Monday reaffirming the city's commitment to upholding civil liberties. In a 7-4 vote, the council weighed in on the USA Patriot Act and the recent release of files exposing police surveillance of political activists. Patrick Nalis reports from Denver.
Four nays, 7 ayes, the resolution passes.
A A crowded Denver City and County Council chambers erupts in applause as the Council passes Resolution 13. The resolution expresses the commitment of the City and County of Denver to civil rights and liberties, making the city a sanctuary for civil rights. There are several local and national policies the resolution addresses. These policies include the USA Patriot Act and secret files Denver police keep on activists. Last week, the ACLU revealed that the Denver Police Department had kept 3,400 secret files on the activities of protesters. According to an ACLU press release, the Denver police have compiled information on such nonviolent groups as the American Friends Service Committee, a Quaker organization dedicated to nonviolent social change, as well as Amnesty International. The police department went so far as to label such groups criminal extremist. Mark Cohen, a member of End the Politics of Cruelty, a Denver human rights group that focuses on issues of police accountability and also a target of police files, helped push the resolution through City Council.
This resolution also addresses that in terms of saying that the police cannot keep files on people, again, unless there's a reasonable suspicion that to believe that they are involved in criminal activity. The police department cannot keep files on people who are doing nothing but exercising their First Amendment rights, which is what they've been doing.
Denver Mayor Wellington Webb will appoint an independent reviewer to go over the files. The reviewer would have the authority to purge but not destroy any files. The resolution also affirms that every person has the right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure, and that arrests may not be made without establishing probable cause that a crime has been committed. The resolution also calls for reduced cooperation of local authorities with federal authorities. The USA Patriot Act has eliminated Fourth Amendment guarantees. The FBI need only certify that the purpose of a wiretap or other warrants is to gather intelligence. Also, the INS has the ability to detain non-citizen suspects for 7 days before bringing criminal charges. Mark Cohen of End the Politics of Cruelty.
We're concerned that after September 11th, the federal government basically has gone way overboard in terms of quote-unquote security, and the adoption of the USA Patriot Act and some other actions taken by the federal government represent a serious threat to civil liberties, the kind of threats that have been represented in the past by, for example, the McCarthy period and the COINTELPRO program of the FBI during the 70s. What we hope to do with this resolution is make Denver a sanctuary for the Bill of Rights, take a firm stand on behalf of the very simple notion that there is no justification for sacrificing our most basic and fundamental democratic freedoms in the name of security.
Even though the resolution does not have the force of law, it is still relevant. The resolution represents dissent to the Bush administration's free-hand war on terrorism and the effect the war has on civil rights. The All Nations Alliance, originators of the Sanctuary for Civil Rights Resolution, wish to see their efforts made into law through the passage of a city ordinance to the same effect as the resolution. Another step is to have Mayor Wellington Webb pass an executive order which will make the resolution city policy. Councilwoman Kathleen McKenzie is one of the co-sponsors of the resolution. She sees the action taken as the beginning of a grassroots movement.
City councils can play an important role of reflecting the desires of the populace at their level, because we're certainly very close to the people we represent. We are at community meetings all the time. We do a lot of door-to-door. We have people calling us all the time. So I think we have a good sense of where the community is at any given time.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Patrick Nalis in Denver.
Free Speech Radio News was produced at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, California, and Community Radio WMNF in Tampa, Florida. I'm Nell Abram.